Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Terry Richard with TDHCA.
Well, this is Belinda Carlson.
Hi, Belinda.
Hi, Terry.
Glad you could join us. Who else do we have on the call?
I think I'm the only one so far.
Okay. Well, we can give people a few more minutes because I did expect a few more to join us. How have you been?
I've just been fine. How about you?
No, this is great. Great. Hanging in there.
Yeah. I'm still recovering from a weekend with the grandson, so.
Oh, well, I'm recovering from a week with my 8-month pregnant daughter in the hospital, so.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, I've been sleeping in the hospital room for a week, so it's been kind of a rough week, but we're getting better, so I'm going to pick her up right after this meeting. She got some bad food and ended up with E. coli poisoning.
Oh, no.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
Oh, no.
Pregnant, and it's been...
Well, I'm glad to know some people don't even survive E. coli.
I know. It was...
Having them there pregnant, I mean, oh, my goodness.
It was terrifying.
Yeah, oh, I don't, that is terrifying. I'm so glad she's getting out of the hospital.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, I have nothing to complain about. I had a fun weekend. So.
Good. You just have one grandbaby?
No, I have a 12-year-old grandson and a 5-year-old.
Oh, well, great. That's your fun. Did somebody just join the call?
Yes, this is Greg Paskatch with Mosaic. How's everybody doing?
Hi, Greg.
Excuse me.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Good. We sure appreciate you participating.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. This is exciting.
Yeah, we're excited. The first phone call we had, we have three work groups. And the first call we had, I think it was about 10 people that called in that were not part of the council. So, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, getting some really good input. So
awesome.
Just glad to hear that. I thought we might just wait a couple more minutes. You guys have 10:05, kind of what I'm showing.
I have 10:01.
10:01. Okay, maybe we'll just wait just a couple more minutes. These clocks must be fast around here. So, Greg, what's your position with Mosaic?
My job title is Housing Finance Coordinator.
Okay.
And so big part of my job is packaging grants and, bank loans and various financial tools to be able to get our construction projects done. So we have done some tax credit projects.
Oh.
We also did a lot of HUD 811, lots of home dollars and various other sorts of funding. So I also work on the back end a little bit as well with some operations, but like any good nonprofit, you have many hats that you wear.
Sure.
So,
I understand. So you did housing tax credit properties here in Texas?
In Texas, no.
Okay.
There are Nebraska and one in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, in terms of Texas, we have down in Austin have three small 811 projects, but that's
okay.
In terms of quote unquote affordable housing in Texas. That's what we have. We own various other properties, but just privately.
Yeah, I tried to do a little bit of research. You guys are also home and community-based services or CLAS providers. So
yes, and certainly the supportive service part is really the bread and butter, as it were, of the company. That's our primary mission. And housing, just over the years, given the population we're serving is extremely low income, it became very beneficial for us to get into the housing side as well for our folks.
Oh, definitely a big part of the picture. Did I hear somebody else call in?
Yes, Darla Gay with the Austin Chavez County Reentry Roundtable.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Glad you could join us.
Sure.
Hello, somebody just joined the call.
Hi, my name is Linda Litzinger, and I'm the public policy specialist at Texas Parent to Parent. And I'll probably just mute because I came in here to learn, if that's okay.
The only, yeah, and it's mute is fine on hold. Just make sure and don't put us on hold.
Oh, no problem.
Okay, great, great. I was, the first phone call was about 10 people, and I know that's kind of a problem with the conference call, and then somebody will put us on hold, and then it's like, oh, dear.
Right.
We hear all the
terrible.
Wonderful elevator music, right?
Yes. Thank you.
But, Linda, this is Terry Richard. We've met several times, so, yeah, it's nice to, glad you could join the call.
Thank you.
And always appreciate people joining in to learn more. So.
Thank you.
Well, let's see. I think we, I know that Jeff Littlefer, who is the Texas Veterans Commission representative, was not going to be able to make it. But John and Marl, did someone just join the call? Maybe that was just mute. Okay, well, there may be people joining as we move on, but I'd like to kind of go ahead and get started since we've got four folks on the call right now. So I wanted to thank you all for joining us. Really do appreciate it and appreciate the input. And I wanted to start with just a real brief overview. Someone, did someone just join?
Yeah, this is Marty Mascari.
Hi, great. Glad you could join us, Marty. Appreciate your participation. So we were just getting into the agenda, and the first part of the agenda was just really an overview of the council activities. And so the Housing Health Services Coordination Council, been around 2006, I believe, and what they've been working on every year, I'm sorry, every even numbered year, parties put together a biennial plan related to expanding and making the capacity of service-enriched housing across Texas. And so one of the first, this was just this past year, he contracted with the Technical Assistance Collaborative, and they started with doing case studies and looking at what other states are doing to expand service-enriched housing in their state. And so I have the link that was on the agenda, but under the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council, entire report. They looked at several of states what same kind of activities they were doing to expand service. Part two of the report. And the states that we looked at, Pennsylvania, they also looked at North Carolina, they looked at Canada. There were several states that they looked at and explained, look at that report and look to see what they identified other states were doing to increase service-enriched housing. And then they produced the first part of the report after looking at what we're doing here in Texas, what we already have in place, what other states are doing, then we asked them to make some recommendations. They made a number of recommendations, and as a council, the members voted to focus on three of their recommendations. Hence, the three work groups that were starting to have some calls and to be able to get input. What we really wanted to do was focus on how do we implement those recommendations. So this particular work group is really focused on the recommendation that adopt a series of incentives, necessary policies, procedures, and great infrastructure within CDHCA's low-income housing tax credit and multifamily bonds program to encourage development of a pipeline of integrated service-enriched housing opportunities. And so that's why we're here today in that dialogue about ways that we can implement those recommendations. So I wanted to start with, just encouraging you all to read that report. and see kind of where they were coming from and their recommendations. And then, did anybody a chance to look at the report, have any comments, thoughts?
Did you send out a separate agenda? The agenda that I'm looking at does not have that link.
Oh, okay.
Did you send out another one? I may have missed it.
Well, I did send out another one.
Okay.
And I think I posted this one. This was also posted on the website.
Okay.
Yeah, the HHSC website. It's a pretty big report, but I think it's like 165 pages. But it really does have some really great information in it. And I'm sorry if did others get the agenda?
Yeah.
Okay.
I may have just missed. I'll go look for it.
I've kind of been having problems with my emails too. For some reason, it's like when I send out a group message, some people don't get it. So I'm sorry if that may have been the issue.
I could have missed it as well. So please.
But it was a good report and really kind of gave us some direction. And so now what we want to do is take the next steps. This will be the third biennial plan that the council has produced. And so, you know, the first report was really focusing on education and outreach. Second one was really looking more at some other kinds of recommendations there's been some progress on some of those recommendations, like housing navigate. And so this time the council really felt like they wanted to take some recommendations, but really wanted to find those recommendations by developing some implementation strategy. So that's kind of what I'd like you to wrap your brains around.
And let me make sure I understand. This particular work group is focused on implementation strategies around the capacity development of units. Is that what we're talking about, or is it units and services?
Yes, the latter. Units and services.
Okay.
Service enriched housing can look as a lot of different models. Housing.
Right.
And there are some developers that, you know, focus on service enriched housing, but service enriched housing could be someone who lives in their own home and receives home and community-based services. You know, so that really trying to develop more of those. And the house tax credit is the resource that has the most, you know, the most funding that comes through TVHCA. And I think that was one of the reasons that TAC focused on that, because there are, and what they are encouraging the state is to add incentives in the housing tax credit program that would encourage developers to develop more of that integrated service-enriched housing model.
Should we mix some of our comments up with the QAP that's out and this as well? I'm assuming the QAP tried to take some of the recommendations and add some language. Is that? So I don't know. I glanced at the QAP that you had, and I just wasn't sure if that's new, or are these kind of pretty much the same things with some minor tweaks?
Well, I think there were some things that were included in the draft QAP that's out for public comment right now that did incorporate a couple of the recommendations, or did make some steps forward to encourage the service-enriched housing. So particularly in the QAP, there's a section about where developers get a boost. If they commit an additional 10% of units at 30% of the area median family income. So that was added in this draft QAP. That's on page 5 of the QAP. The other thing that was included in the QAP was our Section 811 project-based rental assistance. And so in the section, which is on page, section 8, 11, page 14 and 15 of the QAP included an incentive 2 points, so it's in the scoring section of the QAP, 2 points, and requires the developer to choose one of those options. So if they're in one of the seven metropolitan statistical areas, then they're required to participate in section 8.11, or if they're not, then they can still get the 2 points the way they normally would. If that makes sense. It's but it's on page 12 more about
right.
14 to 15, how that's going to be incorporated.
So I have a question about in the QAP. There was some language, and I'm trying to find my notes now. There was some language around only nonprofit housers were going to get certain credits or certain points for providing. It's on page, is it 13? It says that, rent levels of tenants. It said that at least 20% of all low-income units at 30% or less for supportive housing developments qualifying under nonprofit set aside. Is there not another... is there another section, I just didn't see it, where corporate complexes that are submitting for tax credits could also get points? Or is this just saying we want nonprofits to do this, so we're going to add extra points for nonprofits?
Okay, and let me do a little disclaimer here. I am not the subject matter expert for the qualified allocation plan.
Okay.
At whatever point I start feeling uncomfortable, we'll just have to make sure and I will get the answer for you. This particular question I do know the answer to. We are statutorily obligated by our legislature to have those set aside. And so I think you're talking about on page, and let me find that real quick. On page 6, it's housing tax credit set aside. And the nonprofit set aside is at least 10%. So we're required by statute to allocate or to award properties in that particular category. There's also a second category of set-aside, which is USDA, and we're required at least 5% of state housing credit ceiling for each calendar year shall be allocated to rural development. Then there's also a third one that's at risk, and that's at least 15% of the housing tax credit for each calendar year will be allocated under the at-risk element. So those are set-asides. And those are determined by our legislators.
Okay, and that's just one of the comments I want to make is that if there's things we need to be talking about that would open up more units so that we can get more people into supportive housing units, you know, is this one place that we might have to look at for another set-aside category for corporate applications? Because it's kind of frustrating to see, 500 and 1,000 units going in, and none of them are going to serve 30% FMI below, much less supportive housing units. And so what I'm seeing in the QAP is there's not much incentive for corporate applications, multifamily applications, to partner up to help us with that.
When you say corporate, and please, other folks on the call chime in, when you say corporate, do you mean for-profit?
That's correct, for-profit.
For-profit, because, and this is where I'll be uncomfortable, because I didn't think that we are limited to only non-profit.
No, right? No, I think she's talking about just the benefit by the set-aside in for-profit, but... I think historically, we've had some a fairly significant amount of problems with GDHCA, even I guess making sure the for-profits comply with their service requirements that they put in their applications as it is. And I don't know.
Well, then that's when they overcome that obstacle. But
yeah.
I just want to find ways to incentivize, our for-profit developers set aside units for supportive housing.
Sure.
And some of those things. And that's just as it relates to implementation, it just seems like, have we done everything we can to talk to corporations or for-profit entities to help us with that? There's not built in any incentives, I don't think. There's no extra point. So,
okay.
The only extra points for nonprofits.
And this is Darla, right?
Uh-huh.
Darla, so let me just say back, because I'm trying to capture some of these recommendations. I heard you ask a question about, is kind of where we would, that feedback. And I think the answer is yes. This QAP has to be developed and then approved by the governor. And each year it's about the same time of the year that this QAP, there are multiple public hearings. In fact, there's a hearing this afternoon. It's called a consolidated hearing. And so this is the opportunity to give input on the QAP. And so that is one avenue. The other avenue, however, is that because there's certain requirements that are set by the legislature, then the other opportunity is going to be with the legislature, because it's the legislature that determines some of that. So there's a couple of different avenues. TDHCA has some leverage of what we call kind of below the scoring, below the line, that it's certain points that we have some leverage, but as far as set-asides, and that's kind of mentioned in the report by FAC to some degree, the legislature determines those set-asides. So you have a couple of opportunities to do that. What I'm hearing is that there needs to be incentives for profits to be able to develop service-enriched housing, and that certainly should be included or could be included in the QAP.
One of the suggestions that I have, and I made this when I was down there for the roundtable, is that, it's so competitive and they've got so many people applying and so few get funded that once they meet a certain standard, and I realize the importance of the standard of housing and that you don't want to water that down, but once the developer gets so many points for the standard of housing point, I guess, quality of housing points, I don't understand why they don't allow, and it could very well be for-profit developers, to bid up on the service side. In other words, they have a limited number of points they can get for services, but why don't they allow them to bid them up by, adding full-time case managers, on the site, providing funding for a full-time case manager to be on site, and let them bid, let them compete by bidding up the service side.
And I guess I don't, and this is Marty?
Yes.
I guess I don't quite understand what you mean by bid up the services.
Well, there's a limited number of points you can get in each category, correct?
Right.
As they go through, and some of them have to do with amenities, quality of housing, there's certain minimum points they have to get in certain areas. But once they reach that, why don't they add more point opportunities that once they've reached a certain threshold with the quality of housing, more point opportunities for adding more services?
Okay, so let me say that is just giving the ability, having the ability to get additional points if you go above and beyond a particular services.
That's exactly right. Okay. Let's let these developers, they're all competing. It's highly competitive. They're all very much obviously wanting to get in there and get funded. Obviously, there's there's money to be made, or you wouldn't have 35 people applying for something that, you know, five people are getting funded for. So since there's money in there, why not allow them to, you know, to invest some of that back into the residents and give them points for doing that over and above? In other words, why are they limiting them at such a low level, I guess?
Okay, so let me go to the QAP page 15. Right now you get 2 points in the tenant populations with special housing needs. You get 2 additional points if you choose that category. If they agree to commit at least 10 units for participation in Section 811, or seeking points under paragraph required to satisfy requirements of Section 811, not meet the...
What are you, what page are you on? I'm sorry.
Page 15. And
page 15? Okay, I'm trying to follow.
If where it lays out, but the bottom line is the maximum points you can get for tenant populations with special housing needs is 2 points. And what you're saying is perhaps you could add something in there that says, okay, you'll get those 2 points if you agree to set aside the 10%, but hey, let's give you 2 more points if you agree to, or you commit to having a case manager on maybe.
Yeah, coordination of services seems to be one of our biggest issues in getting funded. There's several entities or funding sources that come through, the other service agencies that provide funding, but really coordinating those services for those people on site and making sure they happen and having that case management piece would be highly valuable. And why not have a place, like you say, give them points for having a full-time case manager on site. Obviously, that would only be economically feasible once you got over a certain number of units. And maybe, under a certain number of units, it would be a part-time person. But let them do that.
Okay, so give some additional points if they commit to having a case manager on site. So that would be a case manager on the property that would be employed by the property.
Either that or that they have a certain level of contracted case management services that they contract for, but it would have to be the threshold, obviously.
Right. Contracted, okay, case manager. But if it was a threshold of a number of units.
A threshold that would somehow level up with the number of units that they have, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So when you said before that coordination of services is the biggest problem, tell me more about
that. I have been in several of the meetings that we've had with people that are working with tenants with IDD. We're working with a group that's working with adults with autism. And all of these have funding sources to take care of the direct need, but having somehow a coordination of services at the site seems to be the hardest issue for us to get funded.
Okay, so let me ask you this. The properties and the circumstances you're talking about, are these individuals that are in Medicaid waiver programs?
Many of which are.
And so my one comment, I kind of came from social services background, if they're in a Medicaid waiver program, any of DAD's Medicaid waiver programs, service coordination or case management, they call it different things in different programs, is part of the waiver program. And
the problem we have with that is the fact that that's available, but there's nobody there at the site to really kind of, watch and make sure everything's not falling apart. Not only that, but to be proactive in making sure these people are successful and not waiting till we're being reactive. In so many situations.
Okay. And so maybe what the case managers and service coordinators, like for CLASS, for example, Community Living Assistance and Support Services, that's a separate case management agency that does that. And what you're saying is, if I'm hearing you right, is that the case management that's required through the waiver program, it's not somebody that's on site that really has more hands-on to see what's going on at home.
That's right. And that also can work between the liaison, between the landlord and the tenant, and you know, be proactive in regards to problems they're having so that we catch it and we can work with it before the people are evicted. All of that kind of thing.
Okay. So
I think what I hear is the big problem we have, though, we can't mandate that every project have on-site services, particularly when you have vouchers that are transferable, so you can go from one property to another with client choice. And so those are the ones, I think, where we start getting into, you know, some problems. But what are the things that we could actually tie into service funding streams that would encourage more on-site connections? I know, like our VASH vouchers in our community, we have no on-site services, so it is a movable thing, and we have 350 of those. So, you know, sometimes you can't mandate that services have to be on-site, but are there some quality checks for funding streams that says, you know, but you have to be responsive to certain, you know, evidence of decompensation or, you know, calls from property management then, you know, to respond within a short time.
But what we're doing is incentivizing. We're incentivizing landlords to provide that by giving them, but we're not mandating that they do it. We're incentivizing them by giving them points for offering it, which just helps us all out in regards to being able to find places that we have people that are vulnerable to where they need, you know, they need somebody there that they can rely on.
So, but what my knowledge is that when you've got funding streams that are going to fund operations or acquisition rehab, a lot of times they're cobbling the service funding stream from a different place. And so that's where some of this gets messy because it's not all in one funding stream.
Mm-hmm.
So like the QAP, there's no services attached to tax credit dollars. It's just commitment that you're going to do it, but you still have to find the service dollars.
Well, the problem has been historically, in my opinion, is the developers have gone out and they found a non-for-profit to make a commitment to them. Well, that commitment, you know, lasts 2 or 3 years until the non-for-profit realizes that they're not getting any funding and it's a total outgo for them. And there's no way to make them, the non-for-profit, accountable because the non-for-profit isn't who the tax credits were given to. They were given to the developer. And so
that's
if the developer
responsible. And that's who's held responsible.
Yeah, so the developer has to fund some of these services. I mean, they can't just go out and say, I'm going to find a non-for-profit that's going to do it for free, and then when they default, somebody else. You know, there's got to be a commitment on the landlord side, and that's what I'm saying is, as these people are going in to this competitive process, they need to be able to commit to what they're going to fund. And then they need to be held accountable to it.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm not so sure, I go with the way the tax credits come down means that the developer has to come up with the funding for services. I think the best practice, you know, probably should be a separation so that the houser is focused on the housing piece and the service provision is not tied into the acquisition except for the commitment they've made to how many units are 30% FMI or 50% FMI and the support services. But I've seen historically is we've got to leverage other funding streams to bring these two or three things together. It's not a one-size-fits-all for the tax credit.
This is Linda Litzinger. I have a comment to make about what we've been talking about. It's been about 5 years. I was in a hearing. It was, I don't remember what housing council it was, but there were all these builders there. And I remember Jennifer saying, you know, I don't want somebody at a desk to help me. I want 6-foot turning circles. in every room, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, in the bedroom, so that I can turn a full circle in my power chair and get out of the room. And I saw the builders' faces. In their mind, they were calculating, oh, this is three less units because now I need more floor space. And they said, you know, we're willing to put a desk in a community area and have a person at it, but they weren't willing to have fewer units. And so I think as we talk about this, we need to be cognizant of the fact that they could get all the points from not having any accessible housing, you know, if we stack the points that way. So that's one thing to keep in mind as we talk about it, too.
And this is Belinda Carlton. I have a comment, too, after listening to everything. Now, I've followed the service-enriched housing since the beginning, and what I understood was this is not about an apartment complex providing services or case management. It's about deeply affordable units. I mean, SSI puts people down at 16% AMFI. So it's about getting the deeply affordable units. It's about locating them units, complexes with access to services that already exist within the community. I think there should be incentives in the QAP for developers to provide those deeply affordable units that are accessible, as Linda Lutzinger just addressed.
But let me just kind of add to that. That was one of the first things that the council was charged with doing, was developing a definition of integrated or service and housing. And that is on our website. And it does include on-site and off-site services. I think I've almost got it memorized, but it's integrated, accessible, affordable housing for people with disabilities who can access on-site and off-site services voluntarily. Voluntary is in that definition. I would encourage you to go read that integrated service-enriched housing definition of how council has defined service-enriched housing. It's voluntary on-site and off-site services. But it does include affordable, just like you were saying.
There's no point in even talking about it unless housing is deeply affordable.
Yes.
Or, for an individual on SSI, has the affordability that they require.
And it needs to be on a bus line for natural reasons.
So one of the other questions I had in looking at the report, because we keep focusing on low-income tax credits properties and trying to link, how the state can incentivize this, are we moving away from housing choice, because we're putting all of our, or most of our ducks in multifamily units, when we have some clients who may not feel comfortable in multifamily units? Does that make sense?
No, that doesn't make sense.
If we want to be in residential areas, maybe single family, shared roommate situations, they have options. I just didn't see a lot of that discussed in the report. It seems to be focusing on creating the low-income house tax credit properties to the service enrichment.
Yeah, I think that, my experience is that, I haven't seen TDHDA talk about funding anything that might look like a group home.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying about shared.
Right. And so that's what I don't think we have much in the way of state funding streams that help with that. That doesn't give much in the way of, supportive housing. There's a lot of talk over in DISHES around sober housing, But I don't think we've got any standards nor, you know, how would the state fund that?
What did you say about this? Is what, housing?
Sober housing. Recovery housing.
Oh, sober. Oxford House. But, you know, the way that Oxford House works is that the individuals who live in that home buy the home. They get down payment assistance, and then they take over.
Now, Oxford owns it, but the community peer manages it. Oxford actually owns the housing.
That's my understanding, too.
Yeah, so Oxford owns the housing, but it's peer-led, peer-managed in each home.
This is Greg with Mosaic. I would like to comment that the discussion over maybe housing size or housing type is certainly important as working for a company who does both supportive services and housing development. We have a lot of folks and a lot of agencies that provide services. Like you said, whether it's client preference to have maybe a roommate or two, or the funding reality as a service provider, that financially we have to have three people together, for instance. And so you see a lot of individuals in that kind of a three-bed home together. And so we'd love to get away from that, but we also have to have the supportive service dollars in place for people. So in our mind, when it's great to have one bedroom and two bedroom apartments in the community that would be deeply affordable. I mean, that's fantastic. And that works out well for those individuals for their housing side of things. But for the supports necessary for them to live independently in the community, that issue is not being addressed. And so there could be ways of structuring the housing projects in terms of access to units. But from a service provider standpoint, and particularly, I don't know if this gets into Olmsted, if we'll discuss that, but the idea of clustering individuals obviously is very difficult. So I guess that's our biggest hurdle in looking at this is having the service dollars match, even though it's not part of the tax credit discussion necessarily, but if we're being honest about how it works in the real world, we need service providers to be able to afford to provide services.
Right. Joy Horak Brown with New Hope Housing in Houston. And unfortunately, I'm out of the loop because it took us 10 or 12 times trying to call in to get into the conference. So I have missed most of it. If I could have the name of someone I can phone after the call is over so that I can be brought up to speed, and then also I do have a comment. And first, my comment is I thought that the focus here was to incent low-income housing tax credits. Am I still right about that?
The recommendation, the specific recommendation.
I'm sorry, I'm not able to hear you.
Oh, okay. The recommendation that was included in the report that the Technical Assistance Collaborative created for us was about adopting a series of incentives, policies,
right,
procedures within the low-income housing tax credit and multifamily bond program.
Right.
So that was the specific recommendation. So I think the answer to your question is yes.
Right. And so are we doing that? Because just a little part of the conversation I've heard doesn't seem to be in that direction.
So anybody chime in? I mean, I think what we're trying to do is make some recommendations of how we could do that. Is that fair to say,
right,
everybody?
Right. How do we implement?
How do we do?
The last conversation we just had was around the state having strategies in place that marry the development of or creation of supportive housing units operationally with service dollars, and how can the state do that more effectively using other funding streams? So I think that's some of the conversation. I know in the report it talks about the Medicaid waivers and some opportunities to do that.
So it would be to the developer to, in order to score with points added to the QAP to show that they are going to bring the appropriate services to match the unit. Otherwise, you know, and we develop low-income housing tax credit properties, supportive housing in Houston. We have almost 1,000 units here. And I do know from participating in the program, we have some non-LIHTC properties as well. I just know from participating in the program that there seems to be an opportunity. What we don't want to create is something where everybody just checks the box to get the points and doesn't really have the services or understand what's required.
Or held accountable for providing them. Yeah, I think that's really been a big issue.
I think that's you know, what would be fruitful. My experience, and I think we've got folks at the department who are guiding this, but my experience is that it's most successful if we actually suggest language to the department.
And we
I was just wondering who's working on that, because I'd be happy to work with that.
Yeah, and we did just talk about that. Every year, the Qualified Allocation Plan and the associated rules, multifamily rules, are out for comment. And
I'm aware of that. I have 4 LIHTC properties, and
right.
So I'm working on my comments now. But I guess I'm just, I missed some of this, so I'm just looking for the meat of the conversation where we're actually crafting language, or I'm wanting to know who's doing that.
Okay, yes, and I think it's fair to say we haven't gotten that far yet. This is the first call that we've had related to this recommendation. I think what we, you know, if that's something that the council, you know, wants to do, and so, you know, this is to the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council, too. So if we want to include some specific language that would be a recommendation in this biennial plan that would say we want this language to go into the next QAP. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes, because I don't think we'll be successful otherwise. And I do think that there is an opportunity here. I believe that there are those in the department who are amenable. But if we just kind of reform and amorphous and we don't have some specific suggestions,
I can't hear. I'm sorry. I can't hear the person talking. This is Belinda.
This is Joy Horrock Brown. I'm talking right into the receiver. So I hope you can hear me.
Now I can hear me. I can hear you fine now.
Okay. So my concern is that I believe that there is some people at the department who are amenable. But we won't get very far if we're amorphous and not focused, so that we have to have clear language that we're suggesting. And of course, naturally, I mean, I'm working on my own comments for the QAP. It would be, is always best to suggest the comments before the draft comes out, so that you're a part of crafting the draft. That's next year's challenge. So I'm just saying, I'm just hearing this being pretty free form, the conversation, and so I'm looking for the path that will actually get some language to them quickly enough that it might be meaningful.
Okay, so this go around of the QA, please.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Are you on a cell phone? You're breaking up.
No, that's really strange. No, I'm sitting here in the same phone. No, are you talking about for this QAP?
Yes.
Okay. And so what we're working on here is the development of a biennial plan that will be submitted not until August of 2014.
So, okay, sorry. I thought this was something we were going to, from reading through this, I thought this was something that we would get started on suggestions now, that would be you know, vetted starting right now, but you're not going to vet until later, right?
Well, I really want to get the suggestions and the recommendations to be able to include in the plan. That's not to say that those those comments cannot go forward, you know, in any discussion that we're having here, that all of you, any of you.
I'm afraid I'm derailing things, but I know the comment period isn't that long from now, which was why I was just trying to understand where we are with, do we have a group that's crafting language, or what can I do to help?
Okay, so let me see if I can clarify. That's not the purpose of these calls, is to develop a group to submit recommendations to this year's QAP. This particular work group is to develop some recommendations, but those may be the same that you're crafting right now that we could include in the biennial plan that's submitted to the governor and to the Legislative Budget Board in August of 2014. So there's I think if you're willing, I mean, I think, and the other group members can chime in, but I think the language that you developed that you're going to submit would be helpful for what we're trying to do here, which is to include recommendations in the biennial plan.
I have a suggestion. I think the real, agenda here is to through this group, decide what we think are the key areas that we need to incentivize in the future in order to, you know, promote service-enriched housing or to better service-enriched housing. And I think that we kind of went through that a little bit, but I think we're trying to develop a shopping list of items that we feel like would be important to incentivize. Is that correct?
Other group members?
Well, there's some broader issues. If we're talking about the how we develop our capacity to expand units as well as linkage to services, there's a couple of other broader things beyond the incentive conversation, because some of it is policy direction about who gets served and how, that I don't think that we haven't talked about today, that I want to make sure that we get into the conversation. So I'm all for talking about incentivizing and how to do that, but there's a couple of couple of steps up conversations that I wanted to talk about how to target and get people served.
Is that Terry Thompson?
That is Darla Gay.
Nelson.
So I'll just throw a couple of for instance. For instance, this report refers very lightly to persons leaving prison as needing service-enriched housing, but it does not go there in any way, stretch of an imagination, in a concrete way about, you know, how do you identify the most vulnerable coming out of that institution and linking them to service housing continuums. And so I think, I'm not sure why that didn't get into the document. It uses the word institution, but when you start looking at it, it's mostly talking about nursing homes and psychiatric hospitals. So that was one policy issue. I wanted to kind of see why that fell off. And then the other was the conversation around waiting lists. And I know at a local level, we're looking at adopting in our coordinated intake system a prioritization process. So we're looking at those that are the most vulnerable and being able to prioritize them into housing. So it's not a first come, first serve. And I didn't see that kind of referenced in the document.
Okay. I wish I had the definition here of service-enriched housing, because the council is, you know, focused on service-enriched housing as defined by the rule that's in place, and it's for people with disabilities.
Right. So there's people with disabilities coming out of prison.
It could be, yes. As long as it's, people with disabilities.
Right. We have the Texas Council on Offenders with Mental and Medical Impairment.
But they don't manage housing dollars or policies.
No, they don't. that they identify people coming out of prison who need support.
Right.
Okay, so Darla, kind of expand on that, your comment about persons leaving prisons, and tell me, sounds like you have in mind what kind of a recommendation or implementation strategy you, tell me about more.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just like, you know, just like if they were on the street, which is what's really happening now, is a lot of these guys are being discharged straight into homelessness. If they're not coming out on parole and they're being discharged, which is more than 50% annually of those leaving prisons are not on any kind of supervision, they don't have housing plans. They don't have connections to resources. They can get connected to Comey dollars, but only if they're identified prior to release and Comey accepts them. But most of the time, Comey is only for those who are on probation or parole. Well, when you have more than 50% of your population leaving prison without supervision, those folks are falling off, and they're showing up in our shelters.
So are you suggesting incentives in the QAP then related to people leaving prisons?
I don't think it's QAP. I think it's how we cobble together the service piece of it. And then the subset of that is the problem with criminal background screening criteria that our properties have, which is screening this population out.
Yeah.
Gary, you said something earlier about, or somebody said the definition of service enriched housing.
Yeah.
And I have it here, and it right. says it says integrated, affordable, and accessible models that offer the opportunity to link residents with on-site or off-site services and supports that fosters independence of individuals with disabilities and persons who are elderly.
Thank you, Belinda.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I know we're getting short on time here. Let me just try to kind of back up and see where we are. I ended up, and I'm sorry, I skipped over the first agenda item, which is about the work plan that I have kind of established. And so what I'm planning to do is have a series of these calls. The next one I plan to have would be in November, and use these calls to develop these implementation strategies that we've discussed. And so the next one will be November. So I've scheduled them about every other month through the next 6, 7, 8 months. So I just wanted to let you all know I'll be posting all the agenda items and the dates and times, call-in number, on the HHRC website. And so I hope you all know where that is, but if you just go to the website, or TDHCA's website, and just click on services, council supported by TDHCA. So I think it is under services. And then you'll see the HHSCC website. And so I'll be always posting the conversations. We also have taped those, and I'm sorry, I meant to mention that in the very beginning too. This was being tape recorded so that people can listen to it after the meeting. But I'll be posting all of those on the website. And so that's sort of how we plan to move forward. And so I just wanted to have this sort of be an introduction and direct people to the report, and then also to direct you to the QAP, because this recommendation really is kind of focused on the housing tax credit portion, or the housing tax credit recommendation. And so let me see if I can kind of say back some of the things that I heard. One of the first things we talked about was incentives for profits. So is there a way that we can incentivize for-profit developers to develop this type of housing? And then the next thing we really talked about is adding incentives in the QAP that would be points that developers could get to offer on-site services, one example being case management on-site services. I'm assuming, I think that was Greg recommended that. There could be other types of services that, you know, a developer might get extra points for. Is that kind of what I heard? And then I also heard about, let's see, Belinda, you all really, we didn't kind of follow up on that very much, but talking about the size of the unit and deeply affordable units. So I heard both of those things. And in the QAP, there are requirements about the size of one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedroom, four bedroom. And so that might be something that we might want to look at. Deeply affordable, that's under, you know, 20-30% AFMI. There are sections in there. We kind of talked a little bit about that. There, in this current draft of the QAP, there is an additional 30% boost for developers who are willing to set an additional 10% of the units at 30% or below. And I think that is one step that maybe addresses some of your recommendation, Belinda. And then
the Service Enriched Housing Report talks about 20% or below, I believe.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, 20%, okay. And then, let's see. Then we also talked about, Darla, I know your issue about persons leaving prisons, and I think we've kind of established that would include people if they're included in the people with disabilities or elderly. But then you also brought up issues about criminal background checks and screening those folks out and really affecting their services.
That is important. This is Belinda again. Because the Service Enriched Housing report talks about that too, and also for individuals with mental illness.
Right.
So that is something we need to figure out a way to address.
Right. But then, Darla, I also heard that, you know, there's sort of a bigger, broader conversation about services and linking people to services beyond just the QAP, but how can we look at other funding resources available to get more services available for people.
Well, and the report makes, you know, some recommendations around, you know, connecting with the local continuum of cares and local public housing authorities in order to partner up on projects.
Right.
And, I mean, I think we're doing that fairly well here in Austin, although we don't have a dedicated project-based voucher yet for, you know, a permanent supportive housing project, but we're utilizing vouchers for special target populations. So but my concern is, and there seems to be some urgency for me to raise this, is that there's some sort of infrastructure that the 811 demonstration project is putting into place around referrals and service coordination.
Mm-hmm.
And the local jurisdictions with continuum of care are being asked to develop their own coordinated intake assessments processes that includes infrastructure. And I know in our community, we're about ready to come out with our recommendations around how we want to do that and what systems we want to use and what common tools we want to use. And I just don't want to see us going down a state path and a local path, and then suddenly everybody says, no, you've got to use my system if you want to get access to these dollars.
Okay,
and this is Joy, and I agree with that. Joy with New Hope Housing in Houston, Texas. There has already been pushback that I've heard in the Houston community. We have already established our system. And so the thought is that the state is being duplicative and should use local systems if they exist.
Okay, so I think that might be a really time-sensitive conversation that we probably need to convene Continuum of Cares into this conversation to make sure that we're not moving down roads that are paralleling, and then suddenly there's a demand that they intersect, and there's already been too much investment to try to do that, or it's going to cost more.
Okay, and I know that
it's already invented in Houston.
Kate Moore is the manager of that Section 811 project-based rental assistance grant that we've received, and a lot of that discussion is going to have to be informed by the cooperative agreement, which we have not received yet. And so while I agree that we definitely need to have that conversation, I think it's going to be absolutely critical that we have a cooperative agreement in hand so that we know what the federal government and HUD is going to be expecting around the requirements. And so I do think it's going to be a really important conversation that we need to have once we have that. But what I'm
the local continuum of care are also being given guidelines to do a coordinated intake or assessment process, and every community is going to choose to do it differently. Okay. They don't have to choose a one-size-fits-all, and that's where I think the conversation could get really murky.
Okay, well, I'd like to end on that because we are running past our time. So I have that noted, and I work closely here with Kate Moore, and I'll make sure and follow up on that, make sure and express those concerns that you both expressed about that. And I just want to thank all of you.
Carrie? Yes, real quick. Will you be sharing the notes that you captured for today?
It's actually a recording. I'm going to do a recording.
Okay. And it'll be up on the website?
Yes, and the recording will be up on the website.
And I have another question. Is there a way to get a list of people you've put together for this conference call?
Well, what I did was I opened it up to people on the listserv. So what we did was we established work groups within our council. And so Greg, Marty, we also have Jeff. We had four members that have officially agreed to be on this work group. But then what I did was I opened it up to anybody who's on that listserv. There's 1,750 people on that listserv. So we opened it up great big to get input.
Terry, this is Linda. Were you okay with us talking, or should we wait for a public comment?
Oh, no. I'm totally fine with people talking. That's really what we wanted. We wanted a dialogue, and we want input as we put together this plan.
Okay.
So no, that was absolutely the purpose of these phone calls and the reason we opened it up. And we've already had one call, and the vice chair of the council was pleased that there were people that gave input. The unfortunate part of it is, I didn't capture who they were other than, trying to get people's names and organizations. I don't have contact information. It was really just to kind of have a discussion to be able to get input. And so, and Joy, I believe your comment about, well, I think all of you have on the HHSCC website, I am the contact for the council. But Joy, I am not the contact for the QAP or for any other group that was trying to put together comments for that. So I just wanted to clarify that.
And are you on the TDHCA website?
Yes, we are.
Your contact information, because when emails come to me, they come through the listserv, and there's not any indication as to a person I could call if I had a question.
Yes, ma'am. My contact information is on the website under Housing Resource Center or under the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council. So I think it's just I feel bad because I can't think of the button, but I'm pretty sure it's under Programs and Services. It says on that website, Council supported by TDHCA and HHSCC. And then there's a lot of information on there. But my contact.
Right. Well, I'm going to see if I can find it. I just I think I probably just didn't spend enough time looking the other day.
Oh no. It's a big website. All these state agencies are big websites, and it's hard.
No, I know. I look on the website often, and I just didn't find you. But I'm going to try.
Yeah. So please send me. And I do think that the comments that you are developing and sending in, I would like to, if you are willing to share, I think it would be helpful for this work group.
Well, it's probably too late to share anything really meaningful about this year.
Well, but it might be really helpful though as we develop the implementation strategy. So for the next year.
Right.
If you're willing to share that, I think that'd be helpful.
Sure.
All right. Well, I really appreciate everybody. Let you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You all have a good week.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.